Support comes from Clintonville Academy, pre-kindergarten through 8th grades. Clintonville Academy now participates in the Ed Choice Scholarship Program and is accepting applications until April 12th. More information is online at clintonvilleacademy.org. Small school, smart choices.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've known for some time about the relation between sunlight and mental health issues, such as seasonal depression. Some use a happy light to help treat the problem in the dark days of winter, but new research shows that exposure to sunlight may also affect other issues such as ADHD or ADD. Joining us now to discuss this research is Dr. Eugene Arnold. He's a psychiatrist and principal investigator in the Psychopharmacology and Related Research Programs at the Ohio State University Neisinger Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Arnold.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
First of all, ADHD, ADD, there's different iterations of ADHD. Does it affect all of them, or is this relate to all of them?
Yes. ADD would be a subcategory of ADHD. There are three subtypes of ADHD. One is inattentive type, another is hyperactive impulsive type, and then the combined type has both clusters of symptoms.
So how was the connection between exposure to sunlight and ADHD discovered?
Dr. Martine Arns, an investigator in Holland, noticed in looking at maps of the U.S. For prevalence rates of ADHD and the intensity of sunlight, the solar intensity, both of which were publicly available data sets, one from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the other from the Energy Agency regarding the availability of sunlight for solar energy. And he noticed a striking congruence of the two maps, that the six southwestern states with the highest solar intensity also had the lowest prevalence of ADHD. It's important to note that this does not prove a causal relationship as such. It's just correlational research. But it does open up new vistas for investigating further the causes and even more importantly, possible preventions for ADHD.
There's a connection here with sleep patterns, right?
Yes. One of the things that the high solar intensity might be doing is to overcome the disturbing effect of the blue light from screens, like from mobile handheld devices and television screens. The blue light from those can delay the onset of melatonin, which is a hormone the brain makes ordinarily when the sun goes down, to tell us to go to sleep. So you can get a delay of sleep, a disruption of the biological clock by having that blue light late in the evening. And it's possible, Dr. Arns believes it's possible that the intense sunlight during the day could help to keep that biological clock on schedule despite the blue light from the screens. There are other possibilities, of course, for that the sun may have an effect. One of these would be vitamin D, of course, which is the vitamin D levels depend on the cholesterol in the skin being turned into vitamin D by sunlight.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Dr. Eugene Arnold. He is a psychiatrist and principal investigator in the Psychopharmacology and Related Research Program at OSU's Neisinger Center. We're talking about ADHD and exposure to sunlight. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Arnold, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there very quickly.
And also, if someone is interested in the studies we're currently doing at Nisonger in ADHD and autism, they could call 688-3375.
So that's 614-688-3375. We'll post that number on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you're interested in that. The exposure to light from TV, computers, and other electronic devices, is that accounted for in the study? In other words, is the study just a snapshot in time, or does it look at those trends or the incidence of ADHD over a long enough period of time where it accounts for that change?
Well, it's actually two snapshots in time. Dr. Arns analyzed the data from 2003 and from 2007, and in both at both times, the association of solar intensity with a low prevalence of ADHD was significant. He also tried controlling for, in the statistical analysis, he controlled for elevation because those six southwestern states are also higher in elevation, and latitude, ethnicity and race, socioeconomic factors, low birth weight, and other things that are known to be associated with the prevalence of ADHD.
And getting back to the whole sleep issue, the connection there is that if they're not sleeping properly, it exacerbates or creates the symptoms of ADHD?
Well, we know that if people lose sleep, if they're short on sleep, they get cranky, irritable, inattentive, and kind of impulsive, maybe fidgety. In other words, sleep deprivation can mimic ADHD. So there is a very good possibility that that could both account for the increase of ADHD diagnoses in the past 15 years, and also that it could open a possible pathway for prevention. The amount of sleep that people at all ages are getting presently is about an hour less than they should be. Kids below the age of 12 should be getting about 10 hours sleep. Teenagers should be getting 9 or more hours sleep. And adults, of course, 8 hours. The actual figures on the amount of sleep that people get is about an hour less than that on average.
If what kinds of practical treatments could come from these kinds of findings? Granted, they're just correlations at this point, but when you talk about treatments, how could that translate?
Well, there are several things that people could do based on the current knowledge, even though it's not conclusive at this point. We know, for example, that a moderate amount of sunlight is good in producing vitamin D. It may also have some other benefits, like regulating the biological clock that I mentioned previously. So sending the kids out to play in the sun rather than sitting on a couch playing video games is one common sense thing that can be done. The exercise itself, of course, is beneficial. There's accumulating evidence that exercise is good not only for physical health, but also for mental health, for mental functions.
What?
So the exercise that they get while they're out playing in the sun is another consideration.
Anyone who's lived in the Southwest knows there's a lot more opportunity to do that because you know from one day to the next, yes, indeed, it will be warm enough and it'll be sunny enough to be outside.
Right.
There's a lot of, even up north where we may have a decent sunny climate for a period of time, you don't make plans as much because you don't know.
Right. And another another practical thing is that the screen time, you know, with the screens that emit the blue light, if those could be restricted from the last hour or two before bedtime, it would allow the brain to start making the melatonin, which facilitates getting to sleep right away.
There are there is work afoot on changing the color of screens or managing the color of screens throughout the day. Do you know anything about that?
I'm not familiar with that work, but that would, if that's feasible, you know, if it's possible, that would be a good move. The incandescent lights have a fairly yellow light spectrum. They don't have much blue light, so that electric lights originally did not interfere with sleep in the same way as the blue light emitting screens do. Fluorescent light, of course, can have some blue in it. So as we switch to more energy efficient lights, you know, the push to substitute fluorescent for incandescent bulbs in homes, we need to keep an eye on literally and figuratively, I guess, on what effect that might have.
Is restricting access to the blue, the screen time, isn't that something that doctors are already recommending parents
yes.
do with their kids, particularly
right.
with kids with ADHD?
Right. Yes. As I said, these ideas make sense even without the new research on the solar intensity issue. But that kind of adds additional impetus to those recommendations.
Well, Dr. Arnold, thanks for joining us today. Mm-hmm. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Eugene Arnold, he's a certified psychiatrist and a professor emeritus of psychiatry at Ohio State University. When we return, we'll continue with Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, you know, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies and see our show? Because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country, and I thought it'd be, you know, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait Wait Live in theaters on May 2nd.
For information and tickets, go to WOSU.org/waitwait. And thanks for joining us today for All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. 36 degrees with sunshine today, warming up to a high near 46. Clear skies tonight and still chilly, a low of 28 degrees. Expect some sunshine and slightly warmer temperatures on Thursday, a high of 56. More sunshine and a high of 55 for Friday. Support comes from the Homeport Nobo on Long Condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
It's Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome back. To fight cancer, we need more information about the causes of cancer, both genetically and environmentally. And to identify those connections, researchers need a large pool of people to study. And the pool must be diverse. Here's former NFL linebacker Chris Draft making a pitch for the American Cancer Society on that score.
I'm former NFL linebacker Chris Draft. Almost 170,000 African Americans will be diagnosed with cancer this year. That's why I'm proud to partner with the American Cancer Society by enrolling in the Cancer Prevention Study 3. CPS 3 will help find the causes of cancer in our community so we can learn to prevent it.
Locally, the American Cancer Society is enrolling volunteers in Cancer Prevention Study 3 on April 11th at the Rife Center downtown. Joining us now to discuss the study is James Dye. He's the Regional Vice President of the American Cancer Society. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us is Susan Olivo-Marston. She teaches at OSU's College of Public Health and is a participant in the study as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I read that in 2008, 500,000 people, men and women, between the ages of 30 and 65 who've never had cancer, besides skin cancer, were needed. How many are needed now? What are they shooting for now? James?
Our goal is still to enroll 300,000 individuals.
Okay.
We're currently at right around 180,000 enrolled.
And it's kind of a moving target, isn't it? It's a rolling number because people pass away, things happen, things change. How does that work, Susan?
James can probably address that better from the American Cancer Society, but I think that's always a concern in these large studies, these prospective studies. As a researcher, it's something that we try to think about, that we know we will lose participants over that period of time.
All right. James?
That's really why we've set the target at 300,000. So once we reach that cohort number, then we will end our enrollment. So it will not be an ongoing or we will not be enrolling any others. So this is why it's really important this year, because this will be our final year and we really need to hit that 300,000 goal and make sure we have a diverse population on board.
Right. This isn't the first such study. They date back to 1952?
It's actually our third.
Okay.
So therefore the CPS-3. And mm-hmm. our first studies actually were very beneficial in showing the link between smoking and lung cancer. And our second study was able to show to prove that link even further, and then also to show some linkage between obesity and lack of exercise and developing cancer.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guests this hour to talk about the Cancer Prevention Study 3. Susan Olivo-Marston, professor at OSU's College of Public Health, and also James Dye with the American Cancer Society in Ohio. If you have a question or comment for them about the Cancer Prevention Study 3, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Before we get to the whole process of just signing up for the study in general, what does the study ask of people? Being a participant means what?
To sign up, we're asking folks to fill out a health questionnaire and to give us a blood sample, just a small blood sample, nothing more than you would give if you were going in for your normal history and physical with the doctor. So mm-hmm. about 7 tablespoons of blood and a waist measurement. And then after that, there will be ongoing surveys over the next 20 to 30 years. And those will come about every 2 years, a health questionnaire.
Go ahead.
That one enrollment day will be the only time that you have to actually go anywhere outside of your own home. After that, it will be health questionnaires.
What if you get cancer?
That's actually a great question. The reason we're doing this study is to look at why do people get cancer. And so if someone is diagnosed with cancer, we will want to get further information as long as they're willing to share it. So if someone's diagnosed, we would ask for them to give us permission to have access to their medical record so that we could find out exactly what type of cancer it was, what the specific pathology was.
And as far as privacy concerns that people might have?
Yeah, all the information is kept strictly private. So it's a confidential study. None of the information will be released. It's the information that we do gather is simply for study purposes.
Susan Olivo-Marston, why did you decide to sign up?
So I signed up last spring at a Relay for Life up in the Olentangy district. And I think as a researcher, and specifically as a cancer researcher, I know how valuable a study like the Cancer Prevention Study 3 is. We often are limited with the type of data we can collect. So a lot of times we will start with cancer patients and ask them to try to remember things, exposures, and lifestyles previously, knowing that that cancer has probably been developing over decades, perhaps. And you can imagine that collecting information in that way is prone to a lot of error because it's hard for people to remember something they may have, the way they may have eaten or exercised, 10 or 20 years ago. So this type of study where they are recruiting people before they even develop the disease and getting this information and then following them for years is just invaluable from a research perspective and the things that it could add and contribute to what we know about what causes cancer and also what prevents it.
Why do they need your blood?
So the blood is actually a really, I think, useful measure and something that makes this study unique as well, because a lot of times studies will rely upon just questionnaire data. But by collecting blood, it will allow the researchers to be able to look at genetic determinants and some things down the road that we might not even know to look for right now. But as advances in technology occur, we may be able to look at them in the future.
Julie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Hi. I was curious if I am part of the study currently. In June of 2008, there was a sign-up. And my husband and I went out to Madison County, and there were many, many people at the high school who were giving blood and everything. The reason I ask is we have not heard from the American Cancer Society in at least, I'm going to guess, 18 months, if not 2 years. And I don't know if it is because the principal investigator, Jeannie Calley, passed away or what. So hope to get an answer and find out what's happening. Thank
James
you.
Dye, can you address that? How often should somebody expect it? And
I would say
Julie?
That that we would be able to investigate that for you. Most likely, you haven't received a follow up because you have not gotten to the point of receiving that next follow up survey. But in your initial paperwork, there should be some information on how to get in touch with the researchers to make sure you are correctly enrolled. And if you call us at 888-604-5888, our CPS3 department would be able to help find out where you are in that process.
Okay, that number is 888-604-5888. Julie, thanks for your call. So how often should somebody expect to be contacted over the course of the decades?
The follow-up schedules for the health surveys is every 2 to 3 years.
For just healthy, normal?
Yes. Okay. Right. And then they will begin publishing newsletters as well to update people on our findings. And when we are able to publish any findings, then those will also be sent out as notices.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. What about diversity? We heard from that public service announcement starring the Chris Draft, talking about encouraging African Americans to get involved. When you're talking about shooting for another 300,000 people, you're also looking for a diverse population. So you may get a lot more than 300,000, but you're shooting for some kind of weighted group there, or what?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to what targets we may have set for specific cultural groups or ethnic mm-hmm. groups, but the more diverse our study population, the better we will be able to look at the genetic, the environmental, the social, cultural impacts on cancer diagnoses. So the more diverse groups we have enrolled, the more knowledge we'll be able to then gain as we go on through the study.
Susan, as a researcher, to what extent is that important to the overall usefulness of the study?
I think it's really important. You know, again, sometimes we're limited by having studies that may be primarily Caucasian participants. And we know that for many different types of cancer, both the risk of cancer and the rates of death from cancer are very different across different racial and ethnic groups. And so being able to look at the differences among those groups is really important.
So Chris Draft, that was actually from 2008, I think, at the onset of the study. Are there public service announcements out there that are targeting different groups? James?
Well, we have multiple efforts across the country trying to get the word out, really in general and specifically to target that diverse population. So
I read that researchers want to identify biomarkers, and that word has popped up a lot lately. Susan Olivo Marston, could you talk about biomarkers and what the difference is between those and just basic genetics or behavior?
Sure. So I think biomarkers is a very fastly growing area of research, especially in cancer. And a lot of times we like to look at biomarkers, and so they might be, it could be a protein in the blood, it could be something in the tissue. Obviously, a lot of times blood is the easiest thing to look at. Because we want to, sometimes it's obviously difficult to follow all the way to a cancer diagnosis. So if we can have some type of biomarker that we know will put someone at an increased risk, that's one of the reasons that they make an attractive area of research. Also, sometimes biomarkers are used to look at how people will respond to different types of treatment. So again, a lot of times we look at biomarkers just because of the difficulty of following people all the way to a cancer diagnosis.
When you're, as far as the questionnaires go, are you asking not just about the participant, but about the participant's family as well? So 10 years down the road, they start reporting, well, they're fine, but their brother or their sister or their mother or their father's been diagnosed with cancer.
There is some of that information on there, and looking at cancer within the family and within relatives to see if there is something perhaps within the family. In terms of the follow-up questionnaires, I'm not entirely certain how detailed those will be in regards to family history or other family members being diagnosed with cancer. I believe those will primarily focus on the individual who is enrolled.
And 30 to 65. That's the age group you're shooting for. What's the magic in that? Why not 20 to 65 or 75, since we're living longer?
Another great question. What we've found is that those who are younger, who are below that 30 threshold, tend to be more mobile and move around more often, and therefore they're very hard to keep track of. And so we really determined that 30 as the age where it would be easier for them to participate on a long-term study and for us to track them down. And then on the other end of that, we are looking at a 20 to 30-year study. So we want to make sure that people are going to be able to participate in that study fully.
Okay. Jonathan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question, I'm curious how the research methodology handles individuals who participate in illegal activities. I'm thinking specifically of various illegal drugs, and whether it controls for that, and whether you factor in, you know, the hesitancy to speak to those matters, and just generally how that type of thing is handled. I can take my answer off here.
All right, Jonathan. Thanks. Good question.
Yeah, very good question. Susan, I may rely on you for a little help with that. But in terms of the health screening questionnaire, some of the things that they ask for on there are how much do you exercise and do you drink alcohol? Do you take drugs? Do you smoke? And I think they factor in a little bit that people may be a little hesitant to give us the truth on how much they exercise or how much they actually weigh. But in terms of looking at that data, that is, you know, we're asking that data, and we want to look at does consumption of alcohol lead to an increase in cancer? But in terms of how scientists may factor that in, Susan, perhaps you could help.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I would say that one of the advantages of the CPS3 study is that it is done via questionnaire. And I can speak as a participant. So I filled out the initial questionnaire at a recruitment event and then got another questionnaire in the mail that could be completed either on a paper copy or online. I chose to do mine online. And I think one of the advantages of getting the information in that way is you can do it in the privacy of your home. So you're not face-to-face with somebody. So it's our hope from the research perspective that people are a little bit more honest. But we do always keep in mind, especially when it comes to publishing results, that, you know, we know that people aren't always honest with how much they exercise or what they eat or how much alcohol they may consume. So it's just a limitation of the research.
But the other thing is, it is a voluntary study, so we're asking people to sign up and to help us in making a difference and potentially helping us find a cure for cancer. And so that draws, I think, a different type of person that wants to participate and that wants to share the information is going to be more honest and more forthcoming with us.
So since 2008, you've signed up about 180,000 people, and you have about 300 to go.
We actually need 300 total.
300,000 total.
So we need about 120 to go.
I see. Okay, 120 to go. Oh, I thought originally it said 500,000. Okay, so 120,000. So since 2008, you've gotten 180,000, and in a year, you want to get 120,000 more.
That's why we're on the radio with you today.
Well, why do you? Is this always the case with something like this? With this big of a project, you're at the last. Working hard.
This is a pretty big undertaking to try and recruit 300,000 individuals. So we're definitely pulling out all the stops now to try to get everyone to come out. So
and diversity, we were talking about diversity in terms of ethnicity and race, but there's also geography involved here too, right? Mm-hmm. So are they shooting for a certain number of people from Ohio are you responsible for just getting a certain number just from Ohio?
Yeah, the area of the American Cancer Society that I work for is the central region of Ohio, which is actually central Ohio and southeastern Ohio. So we have 30 counties. That includes a very large piece of Appalachia. So we're doing a study in Lancaster, Ohio. We're doing a study in Athens, Ohio. And we're also doing one in Belmont, Ohio as well. So those are a little later in the fall. So we're definitely targeting not just the metropolitan area, but the outlying areas as well.
Uh-huh. And but are there different requirements for every state? Are they, Montana, there's just several thousand people that live in the entire state.
In terms of requirements, we have that one big goal that we all share of enrolling 300,000. And we have determined, based on size of cities to size of the states, how many we think we might be able to enroll there. So for us, we're shooting for around 10,000 new enrollees in our division, which includes Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Susan, what do you think the biggest motivation for people is going to be? Is it going to tend to be people who have lost somebody to cancer?
I think it is. I think as James said earlier, it's going to be the people that really have a desire to help us figure out not only what causes cancer, but what prevents it. And so it may be those people that have been touched personally by cancer that
want
to help.
But might that skew it? And all volunteer research is skewed to a certain extent because of the motivation. But if most people are doing it because they've been affected by it, are you concerned about that?
The statistically speaking, our risk of developing cancer is so high that there aren't many people out there that don't have someone in the family or know someone that has been impacted by cancer. So I think that this type of research gives us insight into those potential causes or reasons why people don't develop cancer. And I think that we have such a large number of individuals that we're looking for that will still give us good, solid data that will still be usable. For example, the first study that really looked at smoking and lung cancer, at that point in time, the smoking rate among men was 50%. So we take it for granted nowadays that people who smoke run a higher risk of developing lung cancer, but we didn't think about that back in the 50s. So we did the same thing back then. We organized a group of people who were interested in cancer and passionate about cancer, and so it may have some impact because it's those who have been closer to cancer, but I think the information that we gain is still vitally important.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll put the contact information that people need on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And thanks to James Dye of the American Cancer Society. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ann.
And also Susan Olivo-Marston, professor at OSU's College of Public Health. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
And when we return, we will continue with Wellness Wednesday, this time turning our sights to childhood obesity. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. After years of dealing with his son's addiction, which he wrote about in his bestseller, Beautiful Boy, David Sheff has written a new book called Clean, about the latest research into addiction and recovery. On the next Fresh Air, Sheff challenges some myths about addiction and recovery and talks about his own experiences as a parent. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 36 degrees with sunshine, a high of 46 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 28. Sunny and a high of 56 on Thursday. Support comes from the Council of Older Adults of Delaware County. Can help reduce the stress of caring for older relatives by providing tools and support needed to keep loved ones living safely and independently at home. More information is available by calling 740-363-6677 or online at growingolder.org. And support comes from Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at betheldentalcare.com. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. According to the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control, the childhood obesity rate in the United States has tripled since 1980. But treating children who are obese, changing their behaviors, and managing the diseases that go along with obesity in children is easier said than done. Joining us now to discuss childhood obesity and some strategies for combating it is Bernadette Melnick. She is OSU's Chief Wellness Officer and the Dean of the College of Nursing. Welcome back.
Thank you, Anne. Glad to be here.
So new research recently came out of the College of Nursing at OSU about how to reach children who fall into this category. Tell us about it.
Right. Laureen Smith, who is one of our terrific researchers, has been doing intervention work with children in Appalachia. And what Laureen does that is very innovative is she uses teenagers as mentors and teachers for the younger children. So not only does this benefit the younger children, but it benefits the adolescents who are mentoring the kids in terms of how to eat healthier, how to engage more in physical activity.
It kind of makes sense because younger kids are always looking to the older kids to get signals about how to be cool.
Correct.
To what extent is it helping? Have you been able to measure that?
Yes. There's a lot of measures that we use when we're studying how well interventions improve outcomes in children. We often measure healthy lifestyle behaviors, beliefs, but we get body mass index, which is a very key indicator, as you know. That's how we define overweight and obesity in children. It's ironic, though, that still, many practices, primary care practices throughout the country, are not yet figuring out body mass index for children and not plotting them where they need to be plotted so we can really educate parents regarding where their child falls in terms of normal weight or overweight.
Well, they do that scale, though, you know, right from birth, the kid's at 90% of something,
the
and then they move around or not, or continue up as they grow up. Isn't that what that is?
Body mass index is a special calculation that we make based on height and weight. And when we're looking at overweight and obesity in children, if a child is between the 85th and less than the 95th percentile on body mass index, they're considered overweight. If they're 95th or above, they're considered obese. And what's really, again, sad is that not every primary care practice in the United States is calculating BMI.
And to what do you, I mean, do you think it's just because the pediatrician or the primary care practice, they just don't want to be the ones to tell somebody their kid's fat?
I'm not sure if it's that particularly, but it is a touchy issue with a lot of parents. But again, if you look at the statistics, let's take children in poverty. One out of three children who live in poverty are overweight and obese. That figure is startling. That's preschool children under the age of five who are overweight or obese. And if that situation does not improve, we know as they grow, we're seeing diabetes at younger ages, metabolic syndrome. This is affecting our children. And if we don't have a healthy childhood, we are not going to probably have a healthy adulthood. So it's critical we start talking to parents about healthy eating, physical activity from the time that a child is very, very small.
My guest is Dr. Bernadette Melnick. She is Dean of the College of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State. We're talking about a new study and how a new study that recently came out of the College of Nursing about how to reach children who fall into this category of obesity, how to get them to change behaviors. All right, so you're talking about kids that are under the age of five. I assume it was an older age group that participated in this study, and it's in Appalachia, which is where a lot of, you know, there's a high poverty level in Appalachia. Who are the peers, who's the peer group, or who are the mentors for the parents who actually control a lot of what these kids eat and a lot of their activity levels?
You make a very critical point in that we have seen through a lot of research that when parents are involved in the intervention programs, the outcomes are better. We have, though, been studying, and in my team's research, the effects of a 15-session COPE Healthy Lifestyle program on teenagers. And we have had phenomenal outcomes with it. We're getting ready to publish our latest findings with 780 teenagers with our intervention. And what we do that's unique, and I think we're missing this piece in the whole childhood obesity epidemic, is we're not targeting the mental health piece that accompanies so much of the issues that we see in obesity. Depression, comorbid anxiety, those are huge issues with overweight children, teens, and adults.
What do you mean by comorbid anxiety?
That means that comorbid is accompanying the primary problem. So, for instance, in overweight children and adolescents, we have a lot of research to show those children and adolescents have poor self-esteem. They have problems with anxiety, depression.
Under the best of circumstances.
Under the best of circumstances. Okay. And our team's research has shown if overweight and obese teenagers are depressed or anxious, they don't believe they can engage in healthy lifestyle behaviors. So again, I think we have missed this whole mental health component of overweight and obesity when interventions have been designed for these children.
The teen mentors that are talking to the younger kids, are they all perfect specimens of health, or are some of them in the process of getting healthier themselves?
Well, absolutely. Some of them are in the process of getting healthier. There's no doubt about it. And again, the best way to learn something is actually to teach something. So again, I think Laureen's work is so cutting edge because not only is she helping the younger children, and their families, but she's helping these adolescents as well.
And for some kids, the worst way to teach them something is to let them think that they're having to, that they're in the process of learning something. So how do they do it so the kids are absorbing the information without feeling like it's just another class?
Right. I think there are some wonderful interactive skills building activities built into the program. So that's really important, because engaging people again to do something different than what they're used to isn't easy. Behavior change. I mean, we are talking about behavior change here. People don't change behavior easily. In fact, most people don't change behavior unless crisis happens or their emotions are raised. So you've got to figure out how to motivate, how to engage people to get them to make healthy lifestyle changes.
Poverty, one reason poverty or one correlation with it, and obesity is the cost of food. There's the irony, the dichotomy of a poor diet. Often a poor, impoverished person tends to look like they eat a lot when in fact they're getting a lot of calories but not enough nutrition.
Exactly. Right on. A lot of the foods that folks in poverty consume are high calorie, dense foods, sugared foods, not so much fruits and vegetables, which we know are really important for a healthy meal plan. So even the sugared beverages, I always talk to people about making just one change, just one. Don't focus on the whole elephant, I often tell people, but what can you do today? One behavior change that you can commit to. Let's take sugared drinks. They're very popular with children. I mean, even juice, you know, everybody thinks juice is so great, right? But it has high calorie sugar content in it. So if we can get children and teenagers to drink more water with their meals instead of sugared beverages, that would help tremendously.
And exercise?
Physical activity is critical. So a tip that I give to parents all the time, try and decrease TV viewing time for your children. We recommend the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Association of Pediatric Nurse Practitioners. We recommend less than 2 hours a day of TV viewing time. But, you know, just get out and start walking more with your children, because you don't want to make it a chore. You want to make it fun and a habit to engage in physical activity.
So where do you go from here when there's a study like this and you see the results that you've seen? How do you manifest that out in the larger world?
Well, you're talking about scalability, and that is not an easy task. It truly isn't. When we had talked about evidence-based healthcare last month, I had mentioned that it often takes 17 years to translate findings from research into clinical practice or the real world. Same thing here. We have to figure out, once we get great findings from a study, Lorene's work, my recent work with these 780 teenagers, because we are showing such great outcomes with these programs, how do we now approach schools? Because schools are now being mandated to do more of this type of education and work, but budgets are cut.
And it's not on the tests that they have to take. That the kids have to take either.
Exactly. And that's why it's critical when we as researchers do studies in the schools, if we can tie our interventions to academic outcomes, even better, because schools have a lot of pressure. So our recent study with these 780 teens, we showed higher grade performance with our healthy lifestyle intervention, higher social skills, along with less increases in body mass index. So tying interventions to outcomes that schools are really, really focused on will help as well.
And time's running out. I mean, if the childhood obesity rate in the United States has tripled since 1980, we don't have 17 years to fiddle with.
Not. We have to put a sense of urgency on this, because if we don't, the CDC predicts that 1 out of 3 Americans will have diabetes by 2050. The time is now.
There's the condition known as the freshman 15. I suffered from it myself in my freshman year in college. And that's something that you're working on as well with spring training. It's a new program that you started this year?
Well, you know, our university has a vision to be the healthiest university in the world, and we're serious about that. So we have implemented a variety of wellness activities all throughout the university. Today being Wellness Wednesday, we launched Spring Training, which is a physical activity challenge in preparation for Hit the Road with the Buckeyes this fall, another physical activity challenge.
So what are people doing?
Well, today we launched a scavenger hunt first thing this morning, where people had to go all across the university and find certain buildings, certain things within buildings. So again, get them up, get them moving, get them participating in social networks as teams. Very important. We have wellness walks going on across the university today. We have Zumba going on, all types of fun, engaging activities for people.
What happens when people go off to college full-time, that kind of thing? What do we know about that freshman 15? Is that holding steady these days, or is that just a myth now?
That the freshman 15, although it's widely known all throughout the country, it isn't supported by evidence.
Okay.
The average freshman does gain not 15 pounds,
right,
but an average of 3.8 pounds is the latest data on that. But if they gain 3.8 pounds every year through college, you're talking about increasing, again, body mass index. So I think we have a great opportunity as a university to help our students develop healthy habits, engage in healthy behaviors that they'll have for the rest of their lives.
And what kind of participation are you getting with this?
We are getting, you know, engagement is always what I call a character builder, right? So I would say at any one point in time, we probably engage 10 to 20% of the university in activities that go on. But again, one bite at a time. And mm-hmm. It's growing. Our university was just recognized as the healthiest large employer in the Columbus area. So we're real excited about that. We were featured in Business First.
And you've only just gotten started. You're the first chief wellness officer as well, right?
Correct.
So
we have a great team across the university that I'm very privileged to work with on really promoting health and wellness across the university.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us once again to share your knowledge. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Have a well Wednesday.
Thank you. Bernadette Melnick, she's Dean of the College of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer at Ohio State University. Thanks for joining us for Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series.